Okay, so anyways, maybe we keep that as kind of a high priority. We don't want that.
All right, number one.
No diet.
Keep people from dying. Number mm-hmm. two.
For me is keep people from getting sick. Then mm-hmm. economy, then bowling. And also, mm-hmm. bowling is, I mean, that's part of the
economy. It's related to all of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So, maybe bowling is priority one.
Hmm.
In a way. Or, like, they're all sub-priorities.
That makes sense. Okay. So, number one, bowling. Mm-hmm. Then 1A, keep people from dying.
Yeah. I like where we're done. Now we're making some headway. Gonna have a lot of fun. Gonna hit a home run. In the littlest league possible. In the littlest league possible. Gonna make a big splash. Hello and welcome once again to Tater Tots. Oh my goodness. Thank you for bearing with us through the hiatus. I'm Tim.
And I'm Duncan.
And it feels so good to say those words, slightly better than it feels to say the next words, which are as follows. Today, we will be talking about what is arguably one of the darkest days in Major League Baseball's history, and that day is Disco Demolition Night. I prepared these show notes a long time ago, and life got in the way, and so I don't have any, like, what's like preamble. I'm not really up on what's the news in baseball.
I have one thing.
Okay.
I got a notification on my phone this morning, a calendar notification that I had set quite a long time ago.
Yeah, I also got the same notification.
Mm-hmm. So you know what it said then.
Yeah, speaking of life getting in the way, yes, of course, today is the day that I was supposed to have dunked a basketball by.
How did that go?
It didn't. It didn't, and it hasn't, and it won't. At least not in the near future. There's a gym near my new place that allegedly has a basketball court, which is exciting, intriguing, but not something that I will be patronizing still anytime soon.
Not yet. Not yet.
No. I'm sorry that I couldn't see my way clear to dunking a basketball.
That's okay. You know, probably a lot of people thought 2020 was the year they were going to dunk a basketball.
Yeah.
And how many of them do you think followed through on that one?
Probably very few. They're probably
a low percentage.
Probably were a dedicated few who, you know, are already on their teams and are pretty close to that growth spurt, or have just achieved a growth spurt and just needed to get the technique down. And kudos to them. I'm sure they're out there and I'm proud of them. Maybe what I will do in order to have had some semblance of success or resolution to this year-long endeavor will be to buy one of those basketball hoops that you put on the back of a door, and I'll dunk that instead.
Right. I was considering sending you, I found like a $10,000 pair of like jumping stilts.
No. No, you didn't send me that. What? Are they like pogo stilts? The most dangerous toy?
Yeah, I mean, they're like pogo stilts. They're a little bit more like the blades that professional disabled runners use.
Mm-hmm.
They're designed for jumping, though.
Oh, I see. These are very interesting. My goodness. Kangaroo stilts?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kangaroo shoes. My word.
I think these would help you if you were to attempt to dunk a basketball.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for sure.
They both lift you up and enable you to bounce.
Yeah. I'm going to watch a video of somebody doing this real quick. It's just a very long video before we get cracking into the details. Wow. Wow. I'm still, of course, I'm not the foremost expert on... Wow, this guy's doing a backflip. I can't claim to know exactly what's... He jumped over a car. Yeah, I really can't claim to know exactly what's needed to dunk a basket. Oh my god, backflip over people. I thought this video was over. Okay, now it is. Oh yeah, so the subject of today's episode is Disco Demolition Night, which on the calendar was Thursday, July 12th, 1979, in terms of geographical location. Disco Demolition Night took place on the south side of Chicago, in between games of a twi-night doubleheader between the Chicago White Sox and the Detroit Tigers. The broad strokes, gist of things, overarching, if you stop listening in a minute, all you would need to know about Disco Demolition Night is that it was a promotion by the White Sox wherein fans would be admitted to the first game at Comiskey Park at a discounted rate of 98 cents if they brought with them a disco record with the intent of detonating a large crate full of the records in the interim period between games. That is, if you know nothing about else, if you need to know nothing else about Disco Demolition Night, that is what you need to know. You can stop listening now. Okay.
I hope that you do.
Yeah. All right, great. Now that we're alone, we should start from the beginning. And the beginning is this. It's what is disco?
I love how far back you took this. This is
We got to make sure that all of our bases are covered so that we understand exactly what went on Thursday, July 12th, 1979. So what is disco? Disco is dance music. That's it. It's club music. The first modern discotheques were established in Paris during World War II when certain restrictions of the Nazi occupation made it difficult to hire live bands at nightclubs. So those dance halls, which were still open, resorted to just playing records for their patrons instead. And that's what a discotheque became. A discotheque is like that, like you noted, it's the portmanteau of
the French words for disc and library,
right?
Which is really interesting etymologically, because if you split that up, the French word disc and then bibliothèque, so disco takes from like the middle of the word bibliothèque and the front of the word disc, so it was an interesting shortening.
It has more to do with the idea that music, like that live music, could be records. More than anything else, disco as a genre unto itself wasn't defined until 1973, which is long after the Allies won World War II. But you already know what disco sounds like. We don't have to get too detailed on that. You know about the groove. You know about the horns. You can get a beep boop. You can get a chicken scratch guitar. Do some syncopated polyrhythms, but you do maybe an organ, get some string sections. You can have a synthesized string, you can use real strings. Whatever you want to do. And then bada bing, bada boom, you got disco fever, baby.
Running a fever. Give me the rapid results disco test.
I'm coming down with a mean case of disco fever. And what is the big deal, you might ask? How could anyone want to demolish this? It sounds like a music genre, pretty much like any other music genre, when you take a long view of things. Well, as it happens, disco as a genre gained a particular popularity in urban America in the mid-70s in dance clubs or discotheques that catered to predominantly Black, Latinx, and queer communities. It can also be considered as a continuation of American counterculture from the 1960s, which, is counterculture for a reason. There is going to be some sort of faction that feels some type of way about it and might want to demolish it. I got this quote that I liked from a book called Beautiful Things in Popular Culture by the author Simon Frith, which goes, quote, "The driving force of the New York underground dance scene in which disco was forged was not simply that city's complex ethnic and sexual culture, but also a 1960s notion of community, pleasure, and generosity that can only be described as hippie. The best disco music contained within it a remarkably powerful sense of collective euphoria. Yeah, I mean, which is important because that sounds like something that I want to destroy. I don't know about you.
Do you think there's ever been a genre of music that people didn't want to destroy?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I don't know, like, no, maybe you're right. Maybe everybody, maybe there is someone out there who dislikes every genre of music.
I just feel like the history of new genres is people being enraged at that genre. You know, people were furious at Beethoven for including the chorus in his symphonies, you know?
Yeah, and Stravinsky was the Rite of Spring. Yeah, that's another good example of the people not being ready for it. But what Tchaikovsky did was when he moved to America, he did some arrangement of the national anthem, Star Spangled Banner, in F major or some other like forbidden
people got
key.
Mad.
People got so mad. He was arrested, I think.
Great, I love it.
Or something. Hang on a second.
It's, man. So I don't know. Maybe it's inappropriate to be mad because I don't think Disco Demolition Night is very funny. But there is a certain point in history in which it kind of turns a corner, in which I think it's very funny that people rioted that the ballerinas had their toes in the wrong direction.
Yeah, Stravinsky's illegal arrangement of the Star Spangled Banner added a dominant seventh chord to the arrangement. And the Boston police, not exactly an organization with avant-garde sensibilities, issued Stravinsky a warning, claiming there was a law against tampering with the national anthem. There's not one of those. And so he was made to remove the sheet music from the theater where he was performing that contained the felonious dominant seventh. Yeah, I mean, I feel like the history of hating new genres or like avant-garde takes on music is, I mean, the simplest way to put it is to say that the thing that all those have in common is that they come from a narrow-minded idea of what is like correct music, right?
Absolutely. It's always the same thing.
Right, yeah, it's just like this is acceptable and like everything else is unacceptable. The difference between your Beethovens, your Stravinsky's, and you know, we're talking about a fifth of Beethoven here, or we will be in a minute, with disco.
That's a good connection. I like that.
Thank you. Is that it seems like the basis for a lot of probably is some like musical, if not real criticism, at least pseudo criticism for why disco is unacceptable music. But by and large, this was a cultural attack on people who liked a certain genre of music, because musically speaking, disco is really heavily influenced by Black artists and producers, from Motown in Detroit to the Philadelphia soul sound. And even to the more psychedelic influences of Jimi Hendrix and George Clinton. And it's also worth noting that this is, I mean, it's a very multicultural genre as well. In Europe, disco attracted a huge amount of popularity with artists like Giorgio Moroder, ABBA, and the Bee Gees leading the Euro disco scene. I guess what all those have in common is that there is like an underlying, I guess you might call it like a femininity or you know, a sort of softness and communal euphoria that just would not stand in America at any point, let alone in the mid-70s. But hey, speaking of the Bee Gees, we got to talk about the Bee Gees, because in December 1977, just as disco was peaking as a pop phenomenon, the film Saturday Night Fever, starring John Travolta, was released. Neither you or I have seen this film.
Okay, I'm glad of that, because now we can talk about it with a little bit of authority, at least.
Yeah. I really I don't feel the need to watch the movie, to be honest with you. It feels a little dated.
But you haven't seen it. You don't even know.
It's true, but everything that I know about it feels very of the moment and probably wouldn't resonate the way that it resonated when disco was, like, really big. But I might give it a try. It was, you know, for how big it was really, really big. For how big disco was, Saturday Night Fever was really, really big. It was a box office smash. It grossed $237.1 million worldwide in 1977 dollars, which adjusted for inflation today would be a little over $1 billion, which is a huge box office. I think we can all agree. The soundtrack for the movie featured such Bee Gees classics as Stayin' Alive, How Deep Is Your Love, Night Fever, and further disco standards as Disco Inferno, Boogie Shoes, and the aforementioned Fifth of Beethoven. The soundtrack is considered a bona fide disco classic. It itself sold 21.6 million records worldwide, topped the Billboard album charts for 24 weeks in a row from January to July of 78. It remained on the charts for a total of 120 weeks until March 1980 and has since been added to the Library of Congress's National Registry of Culturally Significant Recordings. At first blush, overall positive cultural contribution was Saturday Night Fever. The wave of disco popularity was cresting. Yes?
I have pulled the list of inflation-adjusted movies by worldwide gross.
Mm-hmm.
And Saturday Night Fever clocks in at number 187.
Oh.
It is one spot above the film On Golden Pond, which I believe was the Oscar winner in 1981, and one spot below the vaunted Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, which is my favorite of the series.
Wow.
And this is fun. Even one spot above Harry Potter is the film Minions. So that's kind of the company that Saturday Night Fever keeps.
I mean, all the movies that you named are
big hits, for sure.
Big hits and representative of at least passing cultural fads, with the exception of On Golden Pond, which I don't think this country ever went through like a big Henry Fonda phase. I mean, we like him.
You know, it was before my time. I couldn't tell you.
Have you seen that movie?
I haven't seen it.
I saw it once when I was probably not old enough to appreciate it, because it's like a very understated movie about Alzheimer's or something. Not so flashy and over the top as Saturday Night Fever, to be sure. One enduring criticism of Saturday Night Fever is that it quote-unquote mainstreamed disco culture, making it accessible to white cishet men through the powerful performance of John Travolta. And it did do this. There can be no denying it. Al Corey, who is the president of RSO Records, which released the soundtrack for the film, credited the movie with quote-unquote taking disco out of the closet, which is
a good metaphor, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. It's difficult to call it criticism to say that Saturday Night Fever did a lot for disco as a genre. To the extent that it is criticism, the way that I am reading it as criticism is that there's like an indication that it overly exposed disco culture, which led to a perception, which was in turn increasingly perpetuated by the media, that disco culture was quote unquote taking over. Of course, when white, primarily cishet men perceive that something is quote unquote taking over, or in other words, growing in popularity, possibly creating a diversity of thought and culture, there tends to be backlash. We've seen this, I think, a number of times in our country's history. And have seen more directly when that backlash tends to be racialized, misogynistic, homophobic, and occasionally violent.
So you're talking about two kinds of backlash here. There mm-hmm. is the backlash against disco culture becoming prominent, and also the backlash from within disco culture about the culture being appropriated.
That's a good point.
So maybe disco was doomed from all sides. Everyone was coming for it.
Just kind of the moment. I mean, you know, everything has a season and everything has a time. Give me a reason and I'll soon show you the rhyme.
Okay.
I don't remember the rest of the words to that song.
I'll give you a reason. It's fun to dance.
Yeah, for sure. Gotta find my corner of the sky is what I'm saying. Okay, Now, having established a little bit of background on disco and the disco culture, it's time to talk about a microcosm of the backlash to disco culture.
Namely,
at large, it would be like the Disco Sucks movement. But the story of Disco Demolition Night really seems to begin in New York City, of all places.
That's where I live.
That's right. And it's not where Disco Demolition Night ultimately took place. So what the heck happened? Well, I'll tell you. In July of 1978, the FM radio station in New York City, 92.3 WKTU, which is now WNYL.
Yep. And they changed it.
Yeah, undergone several changes since 1978. I think that they have had Howard Stern, they've had Opie and Anthony.
Yep.
So it's a radio station, you know.
They do they change like once a decade or so. They will entirely change what they do, and that happened at one point in 1978.
In 1978, they very abruptly changed from being a top 40 soft rock station to being a round the clock disco station. Because, as it happened, one of the station's executives had visited Studio 54 on a handful of occasions and then decided that the market could be exploited to improve the popularity of his station. Nothing more complicated than that. And you know what? It worked. KTU's ratings catapulted it into first place among the coveted 18 to 30 demographic. And this is according to Wikipedia and indeed does need a citation. Quote, during the height of the disco craze, WKTU was the station to follow in New York.
Hey!
Hey.
You gotta follow the... What does that mean?
What do you mean to follow? You don't...
Does it mean to be the station to follow? They just play disco songs.
Yeah, like if you want to know what the latest in disco is, you better tune into WKTU 92 point something. I forgot.
Oh, so you hear the newest disco songs.
I would assume so. I mean, I didn't grab actually details about what lane WKTU occupied in terms of disco on the radio, but I assume that round the clock means that they're getting the latest and greatest in.
I'm sure that they are. I mean,
it was also 1978, which is already like pretty close to the end of, I was going to say pretty close to the end of disco's, but natural death, but the thing is that disco did not die a natural death.
And no, it was murdered
in a lot of ways
who we'll meet soon.
Yeah, in a lot of ways it's not dead, but we can get to that later too.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
Yeah, anyways, yeah, so disco have found a home, and a very popular one at that, in 92.3 WKTU in New York City, and this caused ripple effects all across the country, as radio stations took notice of KTU's success and attempted to replicate it. One such radio station was Chicago's 94.7 WDAI, which, in switching over from primarily rock music to primarily disco music on Christmas Eve of 1978, happened to fire one of its rock DJs, who went by the name of Steve Dahl. It was a 24-year-old boy at the time. Dahl was shortly hired, shortly after he was fired by DAI, was hired by rival rock station 97.9 WLUP, where he capitalized on the publicity surrounding his firing and the abrupt switchover to disco at DAI, and general anti-disco sentiment that was already kind of in the air, to organize what he called an anti-disco army, consisting of his listeners, who he called the Insane Coho Lips, which is a name,
yeah,
of something.
With you so far, here's what Steve Dahl said in an interview in I think 2003 or something, in explanation of the phrase Insane Coho Lips. If you understand this better, please write in. He says, "The Insane Unknowns were a popular gang back then, and I passed the Coho fishing fleet in Burnham Harbor every morning on my way to work, so I put the two together and voila." Thank you, Steve Dahl, for kind of explaining two parts of the three words here.
Yeah, I love
it. I still do not understand what either of those things have to do with his army of disco haters, and I still don't understand where lips comes from.
No, I don't get it. I think that this is a gross misdeployal of the word voila.
yeah.
Yeah, I got one word, I got another word, and voila, I made a new word.
I mean, like, voila suggests that you've done something interesting as well.
I mean, it, like, it seems to circle something, right? You say voila when you're like, this is it.
You've pulled a rabbit out of a hat. Or, yeah, voila, you know what would be a perfect rabbit. Example, right? You put a red scarf in a hat, and you put a blue scarf in a hat. You dump out the hat, a purple scarf comes out, right? You say, yeah, voila, right? Voila. Oh, the insane unknowns, the Coho fishing fleet. Voila, mark, insane Coho
mark,
lips.
Question mark, question mark.
But yeah, it's missing something, because he put a red scarf in, he put a blue scarf in, and then out came a rabbit, right? It doesn't, right, hold together.
Yeah, it. There are a lot of things that don't hold together about this man. but, you know, to the extent that he did explain what the mission of the Insane Coho Lips was, in his own words, the Cohos, as they are called, were locked in a war, quote, dedicated to the eradication of the dreaded musical disease known as disco, which is very strong language to use about a music genre that isn't hurting anybody. In the weeks leading up to Disco Demolition Night, Steve Dahl promoted a number of public anti-disco actions. June of 79, and remember, we're running up to July 12th, 1979, so in June of 79, Steve Dahl and several thousand of his listeners demonstrated at a discotheque in Linwood, Illinois, that had switched over from playing primarily rock music to primarily disco music, and the police were called. Later in June, Steve Dahl and another group of Cohos quote-unquote occupied a teen disco in the suburbs of Chicago. Just aggressive towards teens and suburbs to occupy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what they were up to, why he was leading these. I have an overall question about Steve Dahl, which is like, yeah, how serious do you think he was about his hatred of disco?
Well, we'll get to that a little bit later.
Okay.
But it's, I mean, you know, at any rate, it's messed up, right? Like, this is the thing that, like, really interests me about Disco Demolition Night, given, like, the current cultural,
yep,
kind of climate, yep, is, yep, that, like, you know, it doesn't matter how serious you are, as long as you have access to an audience of thousands of people who are, you know, predisposed to taking your words seriously.
Yeah, I was going to bring this up later, but a lot of this reminds me of the Capitol riots.
It really does.
It's the connections are terrifying.
Yeah, we'll get into it. Okay, so yeah, they occupied a teen disco, terrorized some children in the name of this weird crusade. And at the end of June, Steve Dahl encouraged his listeners to throw marshmallows at a promotional van for his old radio station, WDAI. Which was at a shopping mall where another teen disco had been built. a quote from this incident, I think I read this in one of the old newspapers or something, it says, the Cohos chased the van and driver and cornered them in a local park, though the situation ended without violence, which is great. But in July 1st, a near riot occurred in Hanover Park, Illinois, when hundreds of Cohos could not enter a sold-out promotional event. Fights broke out. The police were called again. These are long in an establishing kind of a timeline for what would transpire. And then there's also kind of an incidental event that occurred in the week leading up to Disco Demolition Night that I thought to flag because it was uniquely sad and mean and mean-spirited for no reason, which is that on July 6th of 1979, when Van McCoy, who was the writer and producer of the disco hit The Hustle, which is a popular song that we should all know, on July 6, 1979, Van McCoy died suddenly of a heart attack. I don't think he was that old. I don't think he was older than 50 when that happened. And Steve Dahl, enterprising 24-year-old radio DJ.
Well, he was older than that at this point, right? Or is he still 24?
He was 24 when he was fired from
DAI. Yeah, he was 24 or 25, wow.
24 or 25, yeah.
A baby.
And when Van McCoy, a person maybe two decades his senior, passed away, Steve Dahl took his public platform and destroyed a copy of Van McCoy's record, The Hustle, live on his radio show, which, apart from being really rude, it's like the extra mile of rudeness to me because it's not even a visual medium.
Yeah.
You have to explain on the radio with your words what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Well, that's kind of his expertise as a burgeoning shock jock. This is actually even more than Disco Demolition Night what struck me as the moment when this got out of Steve Dahl's hands, or like when it went too far. I know that he had occupied discos and stuff, and all that stuff is probably too far, but I don't know, this moment for me really solidified. I think Steve Dahl did this as a joke, but it got so ingrained within himself that he did this deeply mean thing. There's something so disturbing about this action that he probably started hitting disco as a joke, part of it wrapped up in his whiteness, right? But culturally it's easy for him to hate disco, but like, I'm sure he didn't hate it enough to actually occupy discos, but then it started gaining traction and stuff. And it's this moment when I feel he probably in his heart already knew that he had gone too far, but it was too late because he had already signed up to do Disco Demolition Night.
I can only hope so. But the conclusion, like where Steve Dahl's story ends in all this, is so like sad and cynical and makes me think that there is no way that he could possibly be remorseful or have ever been remorseful about this.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. He is in so many ways an analog to Donald Trump, right? Do I believe that Donald Trump, if you had asked him before he ran for president, like all the horrible racist policies, do you think we should ban Muslims from the country? He wouldn't have thought that at the time, but at a certain point when you say something over and over again, it becomes part of yourself. It becomes true.
I can't speak to when exactly that seed would have been planted in Donald Trump's mind. We're kind of getting a little bit off topic, but like, obviously, like the policy people that he surrounded himself with seem to be more like vehemently in favor of those kinds of policies. But he was also on TV in like 2012 being like Barack Obama's, you know, secretly not American.
For sure. And I think Steve Dahl is the same way in so many ways, right? I'm not saying Steve Dahl is a good person at all, just that this feels to me so much like a movement that got out of his control, but one that he kept feeding because he likes the attention.
Yeah, and also because it was literally his job, which in a way is also literally Donald Trump's job to keep feeding that frenzy.
Yeah,
that's enough. We're going to put a pin for now in Steve Dahl. We have... definitely covered him enough for now, and we're gonna pivot to another important character in this story, and we'll do like the Cliff's Notes and make sure we have everything that we need for this episode, because we might talk about him more in detail later. The other important character is Bill Veeck, who is, and we'll talk about it later, one of the most prolific, if that's a word that can be applied to ownership. Bill Veeck owned a lot of sports teams. He he's notable for being like a promoter of sporting events. At times he has owned the Cleveland Indians, the St. Louis Browns, in addition to the Chicago White Sox, who we're talking about today. There's a lot of notes that can go away or be saved for our next episode, which will be a deep dive on Bill Veeck, because he seems like a complicated figure. I made a note here at this point that... probably his prominence is what makes him complicated, as opposed to kind of a charlatan creep a little bit. We'll get into details later. I couldn't help but think about him in relationship to Steve Dahl and wonder if maybe Steve Dahl were like more respected or had like more of a legacy in his field if we would consider him to be complicated instead of like the indisputed villain of this story. But maybe not.
Steve Dahl never had an opportunity to integrate the American League.
No, certainly not.
It strikes me that Dahl is more of he thrives on attention, which I think is true of Bill Veeck as well. But, Bill Veeck was a businessman in a way that Steve Dahl doesn't seem to be.
The important thing that you need to know for this story is that Bill Veeck loved a gimmick.
Yes. Yes, he did.
His big quote... I don't know that he has many quotes, but one very famous quote from Bill Veeck is, "You can draw more people with a losing team plus bread and circuses than with a losing team and long, still silence." And Bill Veeck, I mean, was, you know, just very deft and prolific again at producing those that bread and those circuses. In 1977, the White Sox hosted a little discussed, little regarded disco night, which made anti-disco night a very natural suggestion when Mike Vec, who is Bill's son and at the time the White Sox promotions manager, was trying to find a way to collaborate with WLUP, who, of course, employed Steve Dahl, a notable anti-disco figure. Earlier in that season, the White Sox had had a game against the Tigers, which was rained out and rescheduled for that night, Thursday, July 12th. The Vex had already scheduled a promotion for that game, which would allow teens to purchase tickets at half price. But in order to ensure a maximum windfall and following up on the demonstrably successful promotion of a similar nature, wherein Steve Dahl blew up a crate of disco records while live on the air from a mall parking lot, Mike Vec offered to let him do the same thing at a White Sox game. Again, not more complicated in the moment, it seems, than this, where they were just like, we've done disco, now what can we do?
We'll do anti-disco.
Yeah, we have this guy who's already an anti-disco guy, so why not like partner with a radio station and make this thing happen?
Because the White Sox, they have no moral center. Are they pro-disco or anti-disco? Impossible to say.
Perfectly neutral. WLUP's call number was 97.9, so the ticket price was set at 98 cents to anyone who brought a disco record to be destroyed by Dahl in between games. It is worth noting at this point that the White Sox were not very good that season. They carried a 40 and 46 record into the faded doubleheader, and there was some concern that the promotion would be a flop. Attendance for the previous day's game had been 15,520, which is about 35% of Comiskey's capacity of 44,492. The Vex and WLUP had hoped for a crowd of 20,000. And Mike Vec had, planned ahead. He, smart, prepared for the worst, and hired security in anticipation of a maximum of 35,000 people. As it happened, the doubleheader sold out with all the ticket discounts. And presumably some of the frenzy.
A deep and abiding hatred for the disco genre.
Yeah. The official attendance for the games was reported as 47,795, although Bill Vec later said he thought it was closer to 55,000. But whatever it was, the fact remained that the park was filled to capacity and left some 20,000 people outside the ballpark. People who did make it into the stadium were asked to deposit their records into a large box measuring 4 by 6 by 5 feet. And of course, the box filled up because so did the stadium. And when that happened, the people who couldn't fit their records in the box just brought them with them to their seats. Always good to have a projectile handy, something that is aerodynamic.
Yeah, you can call them whitey whackers.
Easy throw, you can call them whitey whackers. The first game began around 6, and at that time, Mike Vec received word that many of the aforementioned 20,000 who were left out of the stadium were attempting to break in without tickets.
Oh, boy.
And doing what this guy is on top of it. He,
yep.
He planned for this. He has enough security for 35,000 people, and knowing that there are fewer than 30,000 people are trying to break into the stadium, right?
Right.
All I need to do, this is completely manageable, all I need to do is dispatch the security personnel that I hired to the gates to stop people from getting in.
Yeah, hold on, let me do the math on this. So yeah, you have security enough for 35,000 people.
Uh-huh.
And there are 20,000 people outside the stadium.
Right.
Yeah, that checks out. I don't see any issues.
No, yeah, totally. So he just dispatched the security personnel who were on the field. He let them leave the field to go deal with the 20,000. at this point, the fans whose records went uncollected began to throw them from the stands and onto the field. Additionally, fans threw firecrackers, empty liquor bottles, and lighters onto the field. There doesn't seem like there was an inciting incident, really. It just kind of seems like that was the energy that was carried into the stadium that night. potentially by Steve Dahl in promising that he was going to publicly destroy some pieces of vinyl. Tigers designated hitter Rusty Staub reported that he urged his teammates to wear batting helmets while fielding their positions, saying, quote, "It wasn't just one, it was many. Oh God almighty, I've never seen anything so dangerous in my life." The first game was delayed several times to deal with all the debris. Chants of "Disco sucks" rang throughout the stadium, and the smell of marijuana became so overwhelming that it was noted by the White Sox radio broadcast partners on the air. Just to give you kind of a sense of what was going on and what might have been informing, you know, people's lowered inhibitions, and they just...
I think there was a lot of energy.
Yeah.
You know, both chemical fueled and culturally fueled energy crackling through the ballpark.
Just a lot going on. Game one mercifully ended at 8:16 p.m., which is like a decent... That's not a bad... If you have another game to play, that's not a bad time to start. Probably go a little bit later than normal, but...
You know, the games back then were quicker than they are now, so they had probably all the delays accounted for it ending late, sure. But they probably would have played the next game in a couple hours. They would have been okay.
Game one ended at 8:16 p.m., at which point Steve Dahl, who was dressed in army fatigues and a helmet, emerged onto the playing surface driving in a Jeep with his broadcast partner Gary Meyer and Lorelei, a model who worked promotions for WLUP. As they circled the field, the fans continued to throw firecrackers and beer at them from center field, where the box of records was rigged with explosives. They proceeded to lead chants of "Disco sucks," while White Sox pitcher Ken Kravec, who was scheduled to start the second game, warmed up on the mound. It was reported at this point that some fans who felt the event was getting out of control did attempt to leave the park, but were unable to do so, as Mike Beck's security had padlocked the gates in order to prevent more people from breaking in.
Yeah, hold on. Let me do the math on this.
Please.
So you've got a filled to capacity stadium. Mm-hmm. What's that? 55,000 people inside. You can't let anyone else inside because it's already full, but you have
gotta padlock the gates.
They're trying to break in. That all checks out. This is all good so far.
Mm-hmm. So there are 55,000 people captive at this point.
Oh my God.
And here's what Steve Dahl told his captive audience. Quote, "This is now officially the world's largest anti-disco rally." And I want to pause because I think what we really haven't driven home at this point is the fact that Steve Dahl is no older than 24 or 25 at this point.
Yep.
Lest you get this image in your mind of some like cranky old man, which is what Steve Dahl is now. At the time, he was a child. He is younger than we are sitting here talking to each other. So what Steve Dahl told the crowd was, "This is now officially the world's largest anti-disco rally. Now listen, we took all the disco records you brought tonight, we got them in a giant box, and we're gonna blow them up real good."
and then he followed through, I think.
Yeah, kaboom. They tore a large hole in the outfield grass. I really don't know what anyone was expecting to happen.
It's so stupid. So stupid.
They caused like real significant damage to the playing surface, and without any security on the field, between 5,000 and 7,000 attendees rushed the field, forcing Ken Kravec to flee the mound to the White Sox now barricaded clubhouse.
You can see this is the moment when I started having flashbacks to January 6th. Specifically, yes. You linked an old newspaper article in which some of the people talked about how they kind of ended up on the field and they were like, "Oh no, we didn't really intend to run onto the field. We didn't really know what we were doing." And it just it reminded me quite a bit of, you know, you've got a couple of people who are inciting people to rush the Capitol, and a lot of people just kind of moving along with the mob mentality, rushing the baseball field.
Fooling around. It was no riot, said Jim Keane, 30, a Southsider who was at the park. We were just sliding into bases, running around, and acting like the Sox just won the pennant. They hadn't won one in 20 years, so we figured we'd never get a real chance. That actually, that reminds me a lot of like the perspective of people who were not explicitly trying to overthrow the government, but who were still there.
You just get swept up on it, right? You got a couple of people who are like, I'm going to go kill Kamala Harris or whatever they were saying, like awful stuff. And then most people just were like, is this what we're doing? I guess this is what we're doing.
Yeah. Like, I never had the chance to run around the Capitol and like steal a podium or mail from another person. So I might as well take advantage of the opportunity. Many people climbed foul poles. They set more records on fire on the field. They literally stole bases. They smashed up the batting cage and more and more and more. Bill Veeck, the owner of the White Sox, took a microphone to home plate to plead with the fans to no avail. Furthermore, then White Sox broadcaster, Harry Carey, was deployed to the PA system to sing, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Which in all of this, like, this is sounds like a really scary scene, but that is so funny. Just the image of all this wanton destruction, and there's just a man on the PA feebly singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game to try to get people to stop.
He's got a funny voice too. Everybody's locked in, things are on fire, there's a hole in the outfield, Harry Carey's singing
Take Me Out to the Ball Game. One thing that we skipped over when we were talking about Bill Veeck earlier, but that now seems kind of relevant, is that Bill Veeck was responsible for a lot of innovations with the White Sox, in terms of baseball at large, as an owner of the White Sox. One innovation of his was that he introduced to Comiskey Park baseball's first video scoreboard, or like electronic scoreboard. Like it has a screen, right? Like even though they're just like yellow pixels, but they can communicate messages in real time.
Would you not call that a Jumbotron?
I guess you would call it a Jumbotron at that point. I'm not really sure at what point it becomes a real Jumbotron that can, you know, play cartoons and stuff.
Yeah, regardless, it's a big old screen on the field where you can see the score.
Big fancy scoreboard that flashed a message to the fans that said, please return to your seats.
That's better than Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
In a way, yes it is. But hey, what would you think about Steve Dahl offering to speak to the crowds? How did that strike you as a plan?
Well, it strikes me a little bit like Donald Trump tweeting out a video.
Yeah. Steve Dahl did offer to appeal to the rioters, but he was declined. Later of that moment, Steve Dahl said, and I quote, I guess they'd felt I'd already done enough. Yes. Yeah, I would say that he'd already done enough. Do you think he could have done more?
Do I think he could have done more? I mean, maybe.
In a way, yeah, I guess he probably could have done more. At 9:08, roughly 45 minutes after the riot began, Chicago police arrived in riot gear to disperse the fans. The grounds crew at Comiskey Park then spent another hour attempting to repair the outfield grass because Bill Veeck wanted to play on. But Tigers manager Sparky Anderson refused to allow his team to take the field. Initially, the game was to be postponed, but Anderson argued to American League president Lee McPhail that postponement could only take place due to an act of God and that the White Sox, as the home team, were responsible for providing adequate playing conditions. McPhail agreed, and the game was eventually forfeited to the Tigers. So good for the Tigers. I think that they split the doubleheader. I forget what happened in the first game. Doesn't really matter to me.
Yeah. I always like it when teams quit. I think they should do it more.
On principle?
Yeah.
Just, like, refuse? I mean, there are very few instances in which I could see that being acceptable.
I agree. And that's why I appreciate this. You know, there aren't a lot of, you know, situations in which it's acceptable for a team to quit, but I love to see it.
Yeah, and I in stories like this one where, by and large, people are swept up in a lack of reason, it is really nice to see, at least in one corner of it, some reason prevail. The White Sox
deserve. It's true.
The White Sox deserve to have that game forfeited.
Yeah, you can see that going another way with people saying, no, we got to play baseball.
Yeah.
So that's, like I said, happy to see them quit.
Yeah. Good for the Tigers. I don't know how the season ended for either team. They certainly didn't win a World Series or anything. In the aftermath of this event, and into our present day, and the Steve Dahl continues to be a creep, a big creep. He consistently downplays the severity of the riot. He did so, in fact, on the air the next morning. Later, he claimed no racial or homophobic animus drove the promotion or his hatred of disco. 10 years on, in a retrospective of the events, Steve Dahl claimed that he no longer hates disco. This is like 1970 or 1988 or 89. Steve Dahl says, I don't hate disco anymore. Now I hate sushi.
That's the perfect encapsulation of
exactly
his kind of conservative cultural position, right? It's whatever's trendy to hate, that feels foreign to you as the most, you know, in his infinite whiteness.
Yeah, and that's why I feel like at no point would he have ever felt that or had the sense that things were getting out of hand, because he seems like he's just predisposed, like you're saying, to just hate whatever is trendy. And I don't, it's not like he's like led a riot against sushi chefs or whatever. Probably has not gotten to that point for him. But like the fact remains that like it's really, really difficult for me to believe that there is no like racial animus here when he's like, oh, now I just hate a different race.
Yeah, I mean, there's a straight line. Listen, so currently Steve Dahl hosts a podcast that is behind an $11 a month paywall, which seems like an exorbitant amount of money to listen to Steve Dahl. But yeah. That's to say, I listened to one of his sample podcasts, but I didn't do a deep dive, and I couldn't because I could, but I'm not going to pay $11 a month. It seems like there's a straight line between anti-disco to anti-sushi to anti woke culture, or you know, whatever you want to say, the cancel culture is what they call it.
What a huge creep. Steve Dahl, I don't feel any pity for him or remorse about all the bad things I've said about him. I think he's a creep. Bill Veeck sold the White Sox to Jerry Reinsdorf in 1981 and passed away 5 years later in 1986. His son Mike Veeck claimed to have been blackballed from baseball for a time for this reason. He left the White Sox in 1980, presumably because of the blacklist, the blackball, to work as a promoter for a high life runtown in Miami. Veeck himself struggled with some alcoholism. Mike Veeck seems like a guy. He seems like a, I don't know. I don't want to say stand up because he did this thing. He did another thing, which I don't totally approve of, but it's another thing where it's like, I don't know him well enough to call him anything but complicated. anyways, present day, Mike Veeck owns parts of several minor league teams, including notable teams as the St. Paul Saints and the Charleston River Dogs, who in 2014 hosted a promotion that included the destruction of Justin Bieber and Miley Cyrus merchandise, which very much echoes, I don't feel I'm saying anything terribly insightful by saying that echoes the sentiment of Disco Demolition Night in a way that, even though Justin Bieber and Miley Cyrus are kind of culturally closer and at this point would probably be more acceptable for me to be like, yeah, Justin Bieber stinks, Miley Cyrus stinks, and maybe with good reason. But still, like, the idea of just, like, doing this kind of act of physical violence against them just really strikes me the wrong way and makes me consider why it is that I don't like Justin Bieber or don't like Miley Cyrus.
Can I have a moment of optimism here? I feel like in the 6 years between this promotional event where they destroyed Justin Bieber and Miley Cyrus, we have progressed culturally to the point that that would no longer be acceptable. I think in 2014, there was still enough of this kind of irony poison culture that that kind of thing would fly among a subset of people. Yeah. And I think we have had a lot of cultural change in the past, you know, 6 years, in the past 4 years, especially. And I think, you know, some of that has gone towards people storming the Capitol, but some of it has gone towards people examining their biases. And I think this kind of violence would no longer be kind of laughed at. So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Another thing that I think probably affects what you're saying, and I agree with what you're saying. I think that I really can't think of any one cultural phenomenon at this point that is trendy to hate in the way that even a few years ago it was trendy to hate Justin Bieber, trendy to hate Miley Cyrus, trendy to hate Britney Spears, which is itself becoming topical. One thing that I think has changed this sort of knee-jerk cultural reaction against certain things is that there are just more lanes for people to occupy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I couldn't even tell you what is the thing that if it were 2014, we would all be reactionary against. Like,
sea shanties. No, I don't think it is. Maybe like a Sia or something. I don't even know.
Well, I mean, sea shanties is interesting that you bring up because there is a kind of a larger cultural backlash against millennials and against Generation Z, but within those groups and among those groups, I think that there might be a little bit more solidarity and a little bit more predisposition to be like, yeah, you like what you like, you know? And so yeah, there's not like any Steve Dolls. Well, there probably are.
There are some, but there's, you know, Steve Dahl, if Steve Dahl were a Zoomer, he would command less attention.
Yeah, and would have his own lane where he wouldn't need to, I don't know, even that's hard to say because like if you like the Steve Dahl right now of people in our age bracket is like Ben Shapiro.
Yeah, it still exists for sure. I mean, this kind of cultural attitude exists, but I do think it's significantly diminished. And again, I think that diminishment has worked its way up through the structures of power sufficiently that there would not be another disco demolition night today. Even if the front office of the White Sox or the management staff like were inclined that direction, there is enough of a sense of what is, you know, right and wrong or what would be unpopular, at least, that they wouldn't do that.
I think you're probably right, and I appreciate your injecting some hope into the end of what has otherwise been like a pretty dark podcast.
Yeah.
The only thing that I would say against that, and I'm sorry to continue to play devil's advocate here, but the only thing that I would say against it is that it is remarkable to me how time and time again things happen, and I say to myself, I cannot believe that people let that happen.
Yeah.
Given everything that we've already learned, I can't believe that we have to like relearn this. But no, I mean, there really hasn't been like a Justin Bieber, like specifically this cultural phenomenon of like putting so much scrutiny on an individual until, you know, enough people are whipped up into a violent frenzy about it. I feel like that hasn't happened in a while, so at very least it's good that we've kind of gotten that out of our system.
I mean, listen, it could be a profound change for us as a culture. Like I said, this kind of attitude goes back forever for all of human history, and maybe we're finally turning a big corner as a species, or at least as Americans. I don't want to talk for everyone.
That would be great. I would really love that. I guess time will tell. Did you watch the Britney Spears thing yet?
No.
One thing that really, really strikes me about that Britney Spears thing is the way in which respected, like, members of the media, like, well, I mean, not universally anymore respected, but, like, at the time, like, Matt Lauer had Britney Spears on, like, Diane Sawyer had Britney Spears on. I don't remember if Charlie Rose is among these, but you know, this is the kind of the class of journalists that I'm talking about. Like, very prominent, very well respected among their industry and outside it. Mm-hmm. And all of those people put Britney Spears on their show just to be mean to her, like with no other purpose than just to be like, what do you think you're doing? How dare you? And like, I can't even imagine, like, this is a point in your favor. I cannot imagine that happening today. Like, I cannot imagine wanting to put a 20-year-old on TV just to yell at them. And like, the tone of those interviews is so like, we have it all figured out. Like, yeah. I'm Matt Lauer, and I know exactly what's right, and you're Britney Spears, and how dare you cross me?
Yeah, Very dark. More empathy, for sure.
More empathy. We've recognized that we're not, you know, as perfect as we thought we were in the 90s, which is good, I think.
I think so.
On balance. All right. That is going to do it for us this evening on Tater Tots. Before we go, I do have a snake fact for you, which is this. More than 450 snakes were used during the production of the 2006 film Snakes on a Plane, but due to a contract stipulation, none were allowed within 25 feet of star Samuel L. Jackson, which is very funny knowing that Samuel L. Jackson like really, really fought for the movie to be Snakes on a Plane, to be what it is. Have you seen that movie?
I have not.
It's a remarkable film. It,
yep.
If it does not have any other like redeeming themes, what it does have going for it is the idea that you can get on an airplane from Hawaii to Los Angeles and not even like that morning, having woken up and going to the airport, you wouldn't even have had like a first thought about there being 450 snakes unleashed on your airplane. And then as soon as it happens, you're ready for it. Like, those people adapted so quickly to a situation that I could never imagine finding myself in. And I think that speaks to the resilience of the human spirit.
Yeah.
Beautiful in its way. Okay. That's going to do it for us this week on Tater Tots. As always, you can make a donation to Baseball for All, which is an initiative that gets you girls involved in youth baseball programs around the country. And it's very important. You can find a link to that in our show notes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Tater Tots Pod. You can like us on Facebook behind the Facebook URL /TaterTotsPod. You can email us, TaterTotsPod@gmail.com. Next week, we will have a deep dive on Chicago White Sox owner and major player in the Disco Demolition Night
saga.
Fair saga, yeah. Bill Veeck, an interesting person in his own right. Might be generous at this point to call him complicated, but that is my line, at least for now. Thank you for listening. See you later.
Bye.
Bye. Littlest league possible.